supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Really begin. What's the impetus? What's the trajectory? How do leaders become leaders? And is it really by choice? How do they manage their frustration? My God, with every civil rights movement, there's many more failures than there are successes. On today's show, we'll look at the intellectual disability rights movement as a civil rights movement. We're doing this in light of a new play called A Fierce Kind of Love. It's a collaboration of Temple University's Institute on Disabilities and renowned director David Bradley and playwright Suli Holum. The first public reading of the play takes place tonight at the Christ Church Neighborhood House starting at 7 p.m. The performance is based on the story of families who've struggled through the 60s and 70s to improve the rights and lives of people with disabilities. We're going to hear from the creators of this performance piece later in this show. But first, I want to get a sense of the ID rights movement with an emphasis on the emotional drama that plays out over the many decades. So to help me, I've got two guests, Allison Carey and Dee Cochia. Allison Carey is a historical sociologist at Shippensburg University. She wrote On the Margins of Citizenship, Intellectual Disability, and Civil Rights in 20th Century America. Allison, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Dan.
Dee Cochia is the executive director of the advocacy group Vision for Equality. Her grown daughter has an intellectual disability. Dee, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Allison, let's start with you. We've been calling this a civil rights movement, and I'm sure you agree. But how does it compare to other civil rights movements we've experienced in our lifetimes? Minority rights, women's rights?
Mm-hmm. Parents in the 50s and 60s were really inspired by the other civil rights movements. Seeing other people break out of exclusion and segregation. For example, if you think about the desegregation of schools and the bringing together of white and African American children. This was monumental as an example for kids with disabilities and parents thinking about their kids having a right to be with other kids, that separate isn't equal, that separate can't be equal. But there are some important differences. I think that disability was for a really long time assumed to be naturally different, that these kids needed to be separate and that they did better being separate, that the medical profession had said they should be in institutions, they should be separate, this is good for them. And so parents of kids with disabilities really had, I think, an extra hurdle to overcome in proving and getting across the idea that their kids should be with other kids the same schools.
I'm thinking about parents who, you know, the majority who don't fight the system, who tend to be more compliant. There has to be an internal battle. I mean, the world is saying to them, trusted authorities are saying, your child will be better off in an institution, and yet I would think their instinct, their maternal instinct, says no. It's got to set up some terrible internal conflict.
Absolutely. Parents were devastated when people would tell them that their children should be put away or that their children should be hidden. This was never easy for parents. And some parents followed professional advice. There are some amazing memoirs of parents who write about losing their child and the grief of that and explaining that to other children in the family about where this other child has gone to or pretending that a child has died, and some parents institutionalize but really maintain close family ties, and other parents couldn't follow the advice, but then they were really left on their own. It was like professionals just turned their back. There was nothing else. If you didn't follow the system, you were on your own. And there weren't books. There weren't self-help books. There weren't TV shows. There was nothing really for these parents.
You know, I look at this movement, Allison, and obviously, excuse me, I look at it through the eyes of a psychotherapist, and, you know, I'm looking at the movement itself as I would a patient. So I'm thinking we did a show on ostracism last year to learn how deep the scars go and how long they last. Even a brief experience of ostracism can cause a lifetime of suffering. And people with intellectual disabilities, like people with severe mental illness, have a long history of ostracism with people pretending they don't even exist. So I wonder what that scarring has done across generations.
I think it's been devastating to many families. And it's not even just ostracism. The ostracism, because once you put people away, they are then more vulnerable to neglect. They're vulnerable to physical and sexual abuse. Families were torn apart. It's not even like you're ostracized with your family or with your community. These are people who were pulled out away from everybody and everything that they could have known, and, you know, and really separated from all of that. So I think it's a pretty terrible thing. I will also say, though, that I think people have found incredible strength through that, that anger, that desire, that those are really powerful emotions and have helped fuel the movement.
Yeah, I want to get to the anger, because I know it did. In the we'll jump ahead to the late 60s and early 70s, and with the help of aggressive parents and certain exposés like what local TV reporter Bill Baldini, who uncovered the abuses at Pennhurst and school and hospital many years ago, you know, he kind of forced it. I mean, that, there you hear the anger. You know, there you hear the aggression that you know, anger is a good thing. Anger is, you know, a natural reaction to injustice.
Absolutely. And I think Bill Baldini did really, he framed that expose in terms of comparing these kids to animals in a zoo and saying that animals in a zoo had more money dedicated to their care per day. And so he was looking to stir up public outrage.
Later in the show, we're going to hear from people who were in Pennhurst. We're going to hear some excerpts from them. The movement really started, you said, post World War II, and you know, you cited Roy Rogers and Dale Evans, and I wasn't aware of that or didn't remember. I was a child, mm-hmm. And then Pearl Buck and the Kennedy family, that they were the ones who broke the silence. What did that do? And I wonder what gave them the courage to do it.
Before Pearl Buck and Dale Evans Rogers and the Kennedys spoke, disability was so stigmatized. I mean, people really thought that not only was the person with a disability a problem, but that their parents were genetically tainted. It really was seen as stigmatizing the whole family. And Dale Evans Rogers, who's married to Roy Rogers, right? And they're these huge American celebrities, and they have all these Christian values. They have the whole cowboy Western theme. And they have a child with a significant disability, and she writes a short book meant for popular consumption, and it becomes a bestseller called Angel Unaware. And what she does, she positions her child actually only lives to the age of 2, and dies of medical complications. And she tells her daughter's story as if her daughter is an angel in heaven looking down. And Dale Evans just basically claims, my daughter is an angel. She was a gift from God. And it helps to change the whole rhetoric. And Pearl Buck, who won a Nobel Prize, a Pulitzer Prize, I believe she's the first woman to win both those prizes, who says, you know, I have a daughter with a disability, and disability can happen in any family. It does not prove family taint. And after these memoirs come out, it's just like, you know, parents have had these pent-up stories, and they've been so isolated, and the, you know, the gates are open, and parents just start telling their stories and reaching out to each other. And they had been doing some of that before. I mean, I don't want to put all of the credit on these famous women, because women had been reaching out all over the country, but it became acceptable to really publicly acknowledge that you had a child with a disability, and that did change the potential to create a movement.
And that opens the door for activists to step forward. I want to turn to you, Dee. You're one of those early activists. Your daughter was born in the early 60s, and that's before there was an official movement. There was voices scattered all around. What was life like for you and her back then?
Well, I was a young mom. I was about 25 when I had my daughter. So, you know, I think the first couple of years we were struggling with the enormity of her disability. She had a lot of physical disabilities as well as intellectual disabilities. And in trying to strike out finding people who could help us, and I think I was much more aware than most of the physicians that I came in contact with, or at least their willingness to discuss it with me. It was hard to find help for her. And she really, once we were able to get some type of support for her, which we had a struggle to do and pay for support from our family, it started to change the outcome of her life.
I want to talk about you. I would guess we're talking early 60s. I'm sure it was you were recommended to have her institutionalized, were you?
Yes, we were recommended to have her institutionalized.
Why didn't you?
I just didn't think that that's where she belonged. I very much wanted to have a baby, and she was mine. And whatever her struggle was going to be, we were going to do it with her.
You've called yourself a tough guy. Were you a tough guy before your daughter was born 48 years ago?
No, I was not. In fact, I was a very compliant kind of soul. I went through Catholic school. I was the kind of person who, you know, whatever I was asked to do, I did it. I didn't even ask why. So it wasn't until I had my second daughter and we were faced with many of these struggles that it became clear to me, especially after I witnessed some things that I felt was not the way people with disabilities should be treated, that I decided I was going to become a zealot.
You decided. Mm-hmm. It was just that easy, and you became a zealot.
Well, I think I just became a zealot. Most people would tell you that I just, yeah, you know, I had one or two experiences where I took on the system and I was successful, and I think that just, you know, kept that fire burning.
Lisa Sonnenbarn, who will hear later in the show, uses the term accidental activist. You didn't volunteer for this job.
No, I didn't. But I didn't certainly reject it either. And once it was clear that we had to go straight forward and find services for her and to help her, I just felt it was my obligation and responsibility to do so.
You started Visionary Voices 15 years ago. What is that?
It's Vision for Equality. Myself and another mom, we both have daughters with significant disabilities. Her name is Maureen Devaney. We started an organization for families and self-advocates to, first of all, bring some level of respect to the role that they play in each other's lives and in the life of the world, and also to monitor services and to advocate for people who are not getting services, even up till now.
Mm. Allison, I want to come back to you. Tell us the mood of the movement at this point?
At this point now, or at this point now?
At this point now, we're jumping ahead now too.
Mm-hmm. We have had incredible successes. There is a need for constant diligence and maintenance. The rights that we have secured in terms of the right to be in the community, to have services, to have an appropriate, accommodated education, those often are things that require money. They are things that require professionals to think outside the box sometimes. And so people still have to fight really hard to make sure that rights are received. And as whenever we're in a recession or when times are tough and services start getting cuts, that affects people's lives. It affects people's ability to participate in the community.
Yeah,
so it's by no means a done deal.
You said politicians thinking outside the box. That's really an oxymoron.
They can do it. They have done it, right? I mean, we have seen laws that create accommodated education, individualized education, personalized services.
Yeah, that only happens one way. And you know, before we take our break, I want to pick up on the anger issue that you talked about earlier. We know that people who aren't being heard when they speak, they begin to holler. And it seems that in the movement, people hollered by hiring attorneys and suing government institutions, and they got good results. So is that where we are now?
People always use a range of strategies, and I think any good movement relies on a range of strategies. I mean, some parents went and talked to legislators and became friends with legislators. They identified who had disability in the family and could relate. Other folks hired lawyers. Other folks worked with professionals. And I think the movement continues to use a range of strategies. They've also really incorporated people with disabilities, and people with disabilities have demanded to be part of the movement, not just parents. But, I mean, at the end of the day, do the courts help? Sure. Do they have to resort to the courts often, more often than they want? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's certainly an effective tool, and we have to go back to the courts over and over. There's lawsuits now about pushing deinstitutionalization further. We're not there yet. There are still people in big residential centers, bigger than they should be.
Allison, speaking of using all the tools available, we're going to talk about other ways of engaging the community, and we're going to be talking about this new performance called A Fierce Kind of Love. So we're going to say goodbye to you. Dee, will you stay with us for the rest of the show? Allison, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Bye, Dan.
Allison wrote On the Margins of Citizenship, Intellectual Disability and Civil Rights in the 20th Century. When we come back, we've got a bunch of guests. I'll introduce right after this short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Guardian Nurses Healthcare Advocates are committed to improving patients' experiences in the healthcare system. In their 10th year, these registered nurses provide guidance, support, and advocacy on clinical and insurance issues. More at guardiannurses.com. Guardian Nurses supports WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, parenting a baby doomed to die soon. We talk with Emily Rapp. Her new memoir is about her son, who, at the age of 9 months, was diagnosed with Tay-Sachs disease, a genetic disorder which leads to dementia, seizures, spasticity, blindness, paralysis, and eventually death. He died last month before reaching his third birthday. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, transforminghealth.org, an interactive online resource offering a comprehensive look at the changing landscape of healthcare in America and right here in Pennsylvania. Videos, blogs, and success stories are available at transforminghealth.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about the intellectual disabilities movement as a civil rights movement. And it's going to be portrayed beautifully in an upcoming presentation, A Fierce Kind of Love. And I'm going to introduce some of the people who are involved in this incredible production. They are Lisa Sonneborn, David Bradley, Soli Holum, sorry about Lisa Sonneborn is a project coordinator for Visionary Voices, Leaders, Lessons, Legacy at the Institute of Disabilities at Temple. Lisa, welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
David Bradley is a Philadelphia-based theater director, arts educator, and consultant. David, hi.
Hi, Dan. Nice to be here.
And Soli is a performer, choreographer, and playwright. She is the co-founder of Pig Iron Theater Company. Soli, hi.
Hi, Dan.
And Dee Cochia is continuing to join us here. And we'll be taking your calls towards the end of the show. We'd love to hear from you. It's 888-477-9499. Are you involved in the disability rights movement, or do you want to get involved? 888-477-9499. Lisa, let's start with you. I love that you're recording oral histories, some of which are being used in making the performance tonight. Who did you speak to? And how did you find them?
Well, we've spoken with so many wonderful people. We have about 40 oral histories to date that we've collected of parents, of people with disabilities, of people who really did lead the way to make incredible changes in Pennsylvania for people with disabilities. In fact, Dee Cochia is one of the folks that we've had the pleasure to interview.
How did you find them?
Well, fortunately, through the Institute on Disabilities, we have a wonderful network of people in the community. We do have an advisory board that advises the Visionary Voices project. And together, the advisors gave us a list initially of, I think, 150 people to interview, which was way too much. It was very hard to whittle that down. But we came up with 30 to 50 people that we thought we simply must interview straight away.
What's it like for you listening to these stories?
Inspiring, compelling, humbling.
Soli?
Yes.
I've got to ask you that question because, you know, one of the downfalls of being in the studio live with me is I get to see stuff, and you were moved to tears in the first segment. So what's this work like for you?
I'm frequently moved to tears. I would add to the list that Lisa just gave, heart-wrenching. But I would also say transformative. My experience in working on this project has changed the way that I see the world, which is always what I'm looking for when I'm making work.
How so?
I came to this project with very little. I had very little contact with the intellectual disabilities community, so to walk into a room. We started with a couple days of just listening. They were called listening days, and we did these listening marathons where groups of people came in and just told their stories. I shed a lot of tears.
That's it's a very difficult job. Yeah. Just keeping your mouth shut and listening.
It is.
It really is.
And that was transforming, obviously. And also overwhelming at first to think that I had been given the responsibility to listen and then to shape and share.
Can we come in a little bit closer to your experience? Not to the microphone, your experience.
Sure.
What was transformative? What were you hearing, seeing?
Well, on a very practical level or maybe very personal level, I, as a theater maker, was being asked to create a piece that was that not only told us, not only told the stories of this community, but was representative of this community. And one of the things that that hit me, perhaps the strongest on those first couple of days, was a group of self-advocates who came in, and one of the first things they said was, "Are we extras, or are we a part of this?" And I thought, "You're a part of this." That's one of the things I've been challenged to do. And I also thought, I don't know how to do that.
When you say self-advocates.
I'm folks with intellectual disabilities.
Right.
So I had never made a piece with someone with intellectual disabilities before. I did. How do I write for someone with intellectual disabilities? How do we stage something? And so I knew right away that this project was going to change the way that I make work.
Mm.
So, you know, not just how I feel about things, but actually how I make
work. How you do what you do.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the project with you, Sully, and you, David, and what it actually is, what it looks like. First of all, David, let me ask you, where did the title come from, A Fierce Kind of Love?
In those listening days, I remember after we had 2 days, and after the first one, Sully and I were driving home, and we were talking. I said, you know, hearing these stories, it starts with you have a child, and you love your kid. And when you love your kid, you then start to figure out, you know, any kid, you know, what's her life going to be like? What's his life going to be? How do you love your kid? And in these stories we were hearing, people were being challenged to continue to say, I love my kid and I want to find a way to be a family. And so we started to really hear all of these stories with the lens of, this is about parents loving their kids, siblings loving their kids, self-advocates saying, I love my life and I want to have it. So that became a lens. And we kept looking at that as an engine, because these were finally very personal stories. Both Sully and I, Lisa, we're all parents. So you have that personal attachment, and that the fierceness of someone like Dee and the other folks that she's worked with and the other people we've heard from, the fierceness of the love.
So what's it going to look like tonight?
Well, tonight's a reading. It's the first public reading of the play. And so a reading's different than a full production just anyway, because this, you know, you put the script right out there in a binder on a music stand so that you're saying, it's a reading. It's a step along the way. One of the things that we talked about this week as we were working on it is, this is, kind of put the word play aside, this is an event. It features monologues. Monologues of mothers, and Lisa coined the great phrase "momologues." It features ensemble work where you'll hear a chorus of people voicing some of these experiences. It features movement that we drew from the gestures that in the stories people told, and it features music. So it's a collage of experiences.
Well,
it's not one story.
Yeah, in a couple of minutes, we're going to hear some excerpts of some of the readings. David, your work, as you said in your bio, explores the intersection of art, public history, and civic engagement. So this seems perfect.
It was great to get an email from Lisa about a year and a half ago. I'd never met her, and I got an email from her 2 days after we, unbeknownst to us, we're both sitting together in the lobby of the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. I was talking about one project, she was talking about this project, and then she emailed me and said, I hear you're interested in this kind of stuff, and I saw she had seen a piece that Sully and I had made at the Constitution Center. And so she invited me in, and it really is something that I'm very interested in, that Sully and I really enjoy working on together. How do you take memory? How do you take actual stories and events? And how do you take the things that people are ardently engaged with and use, you know, and make a piece of theater that offers a new window into it?
Tell me about the civic engagement part.
Well, it one way will start tonight, because we'll get a chance to talk with whoever comes to the reading afterwards and hear their thoughts, hear more stories. There is in the lobby of the Christchurch Neighborhood House a big town hall wall where people can start to share their feelings. And any kind of theater is an arena. It's a meeting place for exchange and ideas. And this kind of work, I think, can stimulate a new kind of engagement.
So let me turn to you, Lisa. You tell me about what civic engagement means. What do you want to come out of this?
Well, certainly we realized that people outside the disability community weren't really aware of the history of this movement. In many ways, it's remained a hidden history. But we're also concerned that people with disabilities and families aren't engaged in their own history. It's interesting, one of the young actors that we're working with who has an intellectual disability, we were working on a section about Pennhurst, and later he said, "What's Pennhurst?" And that was sort of a good news, bad news scenario. How wonderful that he didn't live in the shadow of Pennhurst, and yet that connection is really important to history. So we're certainly hoping that through public performance we'll not only engage audiences that are new to us, but also reignite the passions of the movement within our own community.
I want to reintroduce you guys, and then I want you to introduce us to a reading here that we're going to hear on Fierce Kind of Love. You were just listening to Lisa Sonnenberg. She's project coordinator for Visionary Voices. I'll get my tongue together here. She's pretty much the prime mover of this project and running the project. The performance is David Bradley. He's a Philadelphia-based theater director. And Suli Holam, she's a performer, choreographer, and playwright. We're also joined here by Dee Kochia. She's the executive director of Vision for Equality, and she participated in this performance. So, all right, back to you, Lisa. I want to listen to an excerpt that was recorded last week during a read-through. So, Lisa, will you set it up for us?
Sure. This is a really exciting excerpt, I think. It represents all of the members of our ensemble. And they're presenting what it might have been like to be at Pennhurst, to be a resident at Pennhurst. And what's interesting is the idea was inspired by a conversation that happened in one of our workshops between two of our actors, Aaron McNulty and Leanne Etzold, and you'll hear their voices first.
So these are based on real experience.
Absolutely.
Of people who were at Pennhurst.
Yes, you're right.
Okay, let's listen.
This no ghost. It was a real place. People lived there.
People lived there.
I fell in love there.
I worked there. I had a job. I had friends. I lived my life there.
People slept in cages there.
They didn't give me any clothes.
I was strapped to a chair there.
People were trapped there.
I was burned with cigarettes. I was punched.
Kicked.
Bruised and scarred. I was raped.
I was 10 years old.
I was 65 years old. I was just a baby.
It smelled like urine.
I forgot how to walk.
I forgot how to talk.
I forgot my own name.
That's pretty painful to listen to, and I'm sure, even though you've heard this before, it's still painful. What was it like for you, Suli, listening to these stories?
Deeply moving and also angering. It made me very angry.
Yeah.
And frustrated that I had been so ignorant of this story. You know, there's the anger that you feel coming to these stories that these things were allowed to happen. And then there's the anger at, I don't know, the educational system, our culture, that we don't value and remember these stories as an essential part of our understanding of how our culture, how our society works, you know.
Let's see if we can get a call on before our break. We've got Susan on the line. Oh, I guess we don't have Susan on the line. We had another caller who would like a more specific idea about how these programs really do make a difference to the movement. I guess we'll turn to you, Lisa. How do they make a difference?
Programs like our play, like public performance?
Yeah.
Well, I think what it's doing is it's engaging communities in a conversation, and I think the change starts with that conversation.
Anybody want to add to that? David?
These are stories that don't get told. I grew up in this area. Mm-hmm. These are not stories that we hear a lot, and these are important stories, and they're an important American story because we're constantly trying to live up to the promise of who gets to be included in We the People. And this is another theme of that. And you've got to give voice to the things that haven't been voiced for change to happen.
We're going to take a short break. When we do, we'll hear another excerpt from A Fierce Kind of Love and hopefully take some of your phone calls at 888-477-9499. We're talking about the intellectual disability movement as a civil rights movement. We're with Lisa Sonnemore and David Bradley, Suli Holum, and Dee Kochia. We'll be back in just 60 seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
The Richard A. Reif Heart Institute of Doylestown Hospital supports WHYY. When a heart attack strikes, cardiac specialists know it's survival of the fastest. At Doylestown, they've worked to streamline every step of the treatment process, striving for faster care, fewer complications, and the best possible outcomes. Located on West State Street in Doylestown, the Heart Institute is now easily accessible via the Route 202 expansion. Details at dh.org/heart.
Brian McKnight has been at the top of the R&B game since the 1990s.
I think it's been 21 years since my first album came out, and I think I've made too many.
But that's not stopping him. His latest is More Than Words, and he'll tell us all about it next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about intellectual disabilities and the civil rights movement, really, which is what it is. We're talking about a performance called A Fierce Kind of Love that was initiated by Visionary Voices at Temple University. And Lisa Sonnenberg runs that program. David Bradley is a Philadelphia-based theater director, and he was very much involved in putting this together, along with Suli Holum, a performer, choreographer, playwright, and co-founder of the Pig Iron Theater. We're also joined here by Dee Kochia, executive director of Vision for Equality. Dee, you were part of this project, A Fierce Kind of Love, and you're an advocate for those with intellectual disabilities and their families. Do you see this performance as a new kind of advocacy?
Yes, I do. I think it's an important piece to the advocacy strategy that we have over the years, that this brings it to a whole new level. And I think it's really important for this story to be told, and for society in general to begin to see the role that the people with disabilities have played in the civil rights movement. I think it's extremely important. Mm-hmm.
I want to turn back to the project. And Suli, something you said early on about those actors with intellectual disabilities, and this was a whole new world for you. So how have you evolved, and what role are they going to play? What's it like for you, and what's it like for them?
Well, one of the skills that I bring to this process, which I think is a really good fit, is that I make ensemble work. So when I write a play, I'm always writing for the people who are in the room with me, as opposed to being off somewhere writing something that then gets cast and staged. So the process began the way all of my processes begin, where the performers came into the room and we met them and we and we saw what they were passionate about, what they were interested in, and what their superpowers were. Mm-hmm. And then we built an event around those, you know. So you got to hear all of the entire cast. Aaron, who started that clip with the question about ghosts, not only brings a really, her commentary in rehearsal is really interesting. She tends to come out with things at surprising moments, new perspectives on what we've all sort of taken for granted that we understand. So I worked that into the event. Aaron drives sections of the performance with questions. And she also is a beautiful mover and generates choreography really beautifully. So we have a lot of her movement in the piece.
So what do the people with intellectual disabilities, what do they bring that other actors don't have?
Well, one of the stories that's being told in this event is the story of this group of people being in a performance together. So there's the content, the textual content of the performance. Then there's also the act of bringing a group of people, people with intellectual disabilities and people without intellectual disabilities, to make something together, to tell a story together. What we have is a range of humanity, right? That range of humanity is essential to the event.
And that's really, I would imagine, one of the main goals, David, I'll turn to you, is to put a human face on this whole issue.
You said two magic words that have actually really important moment in the play, and people will hear tonight, human face. And it's exciting to see a community on stage that you don't normally see on stage in performance. Different ages, different body types, different races, people with intellectual disabilities, people without. It is a community that lives among us. And to see that on stage where, you know, whether it's realism or this isn't exactly realism, the stage still holds the mirror up, right, to where we are in the lives we're living. It's nice to be holding this particular kind of mirror up.
Mm. I like to play, Lisa, another excerpt from A Fierce Kind of Love. This is a monologue. So help us understand the importance of this monologue.
Well, as David said earlier, this is one of our monologues. This is about a young mom named Nancy Schwartz, and Nancy is describing the moment she gave birth to her son Alex and the realization that Alex had Down syndrome. And in the play up until this point, we've heard the stories of older parents and older generations, and Nancy's story represents where we are today.
Mm. Let's listen.
The year before our Alex was born, one student named Georgie, who had come to my class every day and say, "Hi, Mrs. Schwartz. Hi, Mrs. Schwartz." And I thought he was so cute. And he would always say hi to me. So I'll just bring you to the hospital. And like 5 minutes before Alex was going to make his appearance, all of a sudden it was silent in the room. I just pushed, and there he was, purple. No one said a word, just silent. It was like when it first snows, you know, just. And the doctor came over, and she put her hand on my hand, and she said, "His eyes, his neck, his hands, he has Down syndrome." And the picture that flashed into my mind was Georgie saying, "Hi, Mrs. Schwartz. Hi, Mrs. Schwartz." And his mother, Grace. Alex spent a month in the hospital, in the NICU, on oxygen, and I cried to the social worker, "How can we just make him breathe? What can I do?" And she said, "You just can't make him breathe." And Grace, the woman who I thought of, came to the hospital. I had blood oozing from me. It's not how I greet parents from the school district, normally, in a hospital gown with blood oozing. And she said, "People will respond to him the way that you respond to him." She said, "That's what my dad told me." And all of a sudden, I felt like, okay, I can breathe more. He starts today. Today is his first day in the 3-year-old classroom. He's 3, and he's actually starting with his peers today. His friends at a typical school. He's been invited to 5 birthday parties. It's not just tolerated. He's accepted into this group. And here's a picture.
Dee, I'm gonna send one or two. What was this like, listening to this for you?
Well, I always tell people that I always knew somehow I was going to have a child with a disability. So I guess maybe somehow, somewhere along the way, as this mom points out, something happens to you to prepare you for what's about to happen. And so I can certainly understand what her feelings were during that time. And if anything, it just prepares you for what life is going to be like. It's going to be a little different, but it's going to be a little better.
Let's go to the phones. We've got several people who want to join the conversation. We've got Florence on the line. Hi, Florence.
Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Not well, but we can hear you.
Okay. Well, I just listening reminded me of my brother 50 years ago. He was intellectually challenged. He probably had a third or fourth grade education, but he went to school till he was 16. And finally at 16, my younger sister remembers his coming home and smiles and saying, "I'm free, I don't have to go back." Well, then my dad put him into Pennhurst. And at Pennhurst, he was there maybe a short time. I was about 12. We went to visit him, and he was so, so sad and so crying, "Dad, take me home. Take me home. Don't leave me here." And my dad took him home, and that was the end of his further education.
Thank God he took him home. And my heart breaks for those who didn't go home. Florence, thanks so much for your call, and thanks for sharing your story. Let's see if we can get another call on. We've got Amber on the line. Hi, Amber.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What can we do for you?
I just wanted to share that I'm a parent in Wilmington, Delaware, and I have a son that is on the autism spectrum and also has learning disabilities. He was in middle school and was experiencing bullying in the school just currently, and I wanted to thank the parents that came before me, because the bullying has been written into the civil rights, the Office of Civil Rights policies, I guess you could call it, that it gave me a leg to stand on to request that they pay for a private school, because that the climate of the school, including staff on down, should have been responsible in stopping that. So I wanted to thank you, and you know, I'm an advocate to help that the kids coming after my son also have a better experience.
Well, one of the people you have to thank is Dee, who's right here in the studio. Amber, thanks so much for your call. What's that like for you?
Well, you know, I think it's, you know, when you look at the whole bullying thing today, it certainly wouldn't be unusual that people with disabilities would certainly be a victim to it. But I do think that families need to be very strong. They've got to show a lot of courage, and they've got to ensure that their kid gets what they're entitled to and also has the same right as anybody else to live a good life and fight for it.
Lisa, we spoke with you earlier. You said that leaders of the intellectual disability movement don't see themselves as leaders because the work is never done. What's your vision of where this movement is going and where it needs to go?
Well, I think actually Dee is probably a better person to talk about where the movement is and where to go than I, but from the conversations I've had with parents, one of the things they've all expressed concern about is that the movement might move backwards. More and more people are finding it difficult, if not impossible, to get the support they need to live in the community. Many have been sent back to nursing homes and institutions, which is certainly a step backwards.
Why? Because of budget problems?
Absolutely, because of lack of funding for supports for folks to live independently in the community. So certainly, I think, from my perspective and the Institute's perspective, if our work could contribute in some way to bring these issues to greater awareness and help inspire people to advocate for better legislation, better funding, better support for families and people in the community, then we would feel that our work was well done.
So part of the agenda of this play is to go beyond the disability, the intellectual disability community, to the larger community. That's part of the intent. That's the underpinnings of civic engagement. What do you want from the larger community? What do you want from us?
Well,
or listeners?
We want people who don't identify as being part of the disability community to perhaps deepen their connections with the people in their communities who have disabilities and family members. Think about the issues. Think about them when they go to vote.
Mm, very important. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank all of you so very much for joining us, and I'm deeply touched by the work all of you are doing. We've been talking about intellectual disability movement in light of a new performance piece in the making here in Philadelphia. It's called A Fierce Kind of Love. My guests have been Lisa Sonneborn. Thank you, Lisa. Suli Holum. Thanks, Suli.
Thank you.
David Bradley, who's doing great work over there.
Thank you.
Dee Cochia.
Thank you.
One of the leaders. Earlier, we heard from historical sociologist Allison Carey. A reading of the play takes place tonight, Monday the 18th of March. It's at the Christchurch Neighborhood House starting at 7 o'clock. And next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be discussing a new book by local psychologist Robert Nassif. It's called Autism in the Family. It's another variant on A Fierce Kind of Love, actually. Please comment on today's show. We're at whyy.org/voices. You can download this and other shows there or on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. And me, I'm at drdangottlieb.com. The engineer for the show has been Fred Snyder. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, enjoy your week.
Tell Me More is next on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. Since 1918, the Philadelphia Foundation has built healthy communities. It supports nonprofits.